I don't know where you are, but just come home.
Empathy is the glue that binds humanity together. Families, communities, nations.
Paul or something.
But some people use our compassion.
I'm sorry for all your pain. But it wasn't me.
To save their own skins.
How could we have not seen the signs?
Who deserves our empathy? Who should raise suspicions? What are the warning signs of the faker? As a former FBI profiler, I'm often asked, can you spot a killer? Is it a look? An attitude? A pattern of behavior? After 40 years' experience, I can say it's complicated. But there's one thing I know. There is a deadly type. Bridgewater, Nova Scotia, 2008.
I don't know where you are, but just come home or call or something, please.
These are the tears of a mother for her child, missing in freezing conditions. 12-year-old Carissa Boudreaux has not been seen for 2 days. For Bridgewater Operational Commander John Collier, it's a race against time.
There was a snowstorm just starting as Carissa was reported missing by her mother. And there was obviously concerns that she was out in the storm and not dressed properly for it.
Her mother, Penny, is distraught.
Penny had gone into the store to get some items. And when she returned, Carissa had gone missing from the car. She felt that Carissa was angry at her.
A mother's grief triggers a deep emotional response in all of us. It's why the police ask parents and loved ones to go public and plead for help. It can motivate an entire nation for a call to action. In Bridgewater, neighbors help search, put up posters, and donate money. For 2 weeks, the whole community prays for a happy ending.
I'm just here to reach out to my daughter. Carissa, I just want to tell you that you have lots of people who love you and want you home.
But their worst fears are realized when Carissa's body is discovered by a passerby, dumped on an isolated riverbank.
He noticed a toe was sticking out of the snow. Body was covered in snow other than the toes.
Carissa has been strangled and the body is partially naked. Fear sweeps the community that a sexual predator is on the loose.
This is a community that had not experienced any kind of crime like this. There was that, who did this? Are they living amongst us? And is it going to happen again?
Again, the town rallies around Penny and her boyfriend, Vernon McCumber, in their hour of need. But investigators are uncovering another side to this grieving mother.
Any good police investigator, there's always that suspicion that you're not being told the truth. I mean, the police are often told lies.
The truth of the matter is, the majority of children that are murdered by a parent or primary caregiver.
We're basically, at this point, keeping our minds open to all possibilities. But do we have suspicions? Sure, we had some suspicions. There was a few things. You start looking at it, how she dealt with things in a different light.
All good investigators know you can't take someone's word at face value. and neither should you.
She would cry when she thought it would help get what she wanted. But other times, she was very controlling, very manipulative.
Do you believe Penny's story? You shouldn't. She knows exactly what happened to her daughter. From the moment her daughter goes missing, Penny Boudreau has the support of the entire town of Bridgewater, Nova Scotia. But she's counting on her community to believe her side of the story. It's an effective strategy. Turn on the waterworks. Because decent people, which is most of us, don't want to believe the worst about a person. And that's why Penny was given the benefit of the doubt. But when the case of a lost child becomes a murder investigation, some folks start to wonder, have they been duped by a faker? Evidence begins to point towards home, and it's not a happy household. Penny and her daughter constantly fight. And after Carissa disappears, neighbors report hearing an argument between Penny and her boyfriend Vernon, who demands, "Why did you do it?"
There was some compelling evidence, and it wasn't long after she was confronted with that evidence that she confessed.
The community is shocked to learn that Penny carefully planned the murder, and even more appalled to find out why.
She told police she'd been thinking about it for a while, that she thought was the only way she could save her relationship with Vernon McCumber.
Penny claims that Vernon is so sick of the fighting at home, he gives her an ultimatum. It's him or Carissa. And Penny makes her choice.
She had made a decision that Carissa had to go. She went in the store with the intention of starting to establish a story that Chris had taken off. She then went back to the car, drove to a remote road just outside of town here, basically told Carissa she wasn't going to be coming home. And when Carissa got out, she attacked Carissa. Penny initially jumped on her and was on top of her. Her daughter said, "Mommy, don't." Penny took the string out and strangled her. I think what was the most shocking thing about the whole thing is how she related it to investigators. It was very cold and detached.
The fact that Penny could describe the dying words of her own daughter tells me everything I need to know about her. Her lack of empathy is horrifying.
I don't personally think she was sorry for what she did. The tears you saw when she was going in for sentencing and that sort of thing were tears for herself, that she was caught and that she was going to serve life in prison for what she did.
It took time for the real Penny Boudreau to be exposed, but good police work and good evidence will do that. And that's the secret to identifying the faker. Keep testing their story. Look past the lies and follow the facts. That's what put nurse Vicky Jackson in prison. She was convicted of one of the worst crimes ever perpetrated in Texas.
You started working in the healthcare industry at a very young age.
Yes, ma'am.
When you were a teenager. Why were you drawn to that profession?
Because I wanted to be able to save people. I wanted to be able to take care of them and make them better.
I met former nurse Vicki Jackson 7 years ago at the Crane Unit in Gatesville, Texas. She's here for life, dubbed the Angel of Death, a serial killer thought to be responsible for 20 murders.
Patients were dying at the hospital where you worked.
But Vicki tells me she didn't kill anyone.
There was several patients that were dying more often than not. They were dying of pneumonia, heart attacks. They were older.
In 2000, the Nakona General Hospital is a small facility with just 18 rooms. When Vicki starts working there, the death rate suddenly skyrockets. In just a few weeks, it doubles. Sometimes two patients die in one day.
And you were there?
Yes.
In fact, correct me if I'm wrong, you were the first person in the room to find them on some occasions?
On some occasions, yes.
How many times did you find them?
Three or four.
Police investigation revealed that you were the only person, the only nurse, only healthcare provider that was on duty when these murders occurred.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you see how that looks bad?
Yes, ma'am.
And you were the only one?
At that time, yes, ma'am.
I was surprised at how calmly Vicki talked me through the murders. I can tell you as a nurse, when a patient suddenly dies, it's an emotional experience. But Vicki seems completely disconnected to all the death around her. This isn't the attitude of someone who wants to take care of people. She doesn't care. And that same calm persona is what nurse Vicki Jackson displays at work. As one patient after another dies under her care.
There came a time when a man who was having trouble breathing, when the other nurses asked him what had happened, he said, "You gave him an intravenous injection, and then he couldn't breathe." What do you say to that?
No, ma'am. He said it was a blonde nurse.
A blonde nurse.
That messed with my IV.
Were there any other blonde nurses there?
I was the only licensed nurse there that was blonde.
Vicki is fired, and the unexplained emergencies and sudden deaths suddenly stop. She quickly becomes a prime suspect. The evidence suggests it cannot be anyone else, but Vicki flatly denies it.
Do you recall what you thought?
I thought it was crazy. I thought, you know, it's all gonna be answered. Surely they can't really mean this.
But they did.
Yes, they did.
They did. And you told them what?
That I was innocent.
Regarding the murders.
That I was innocent.
You were innocent.
Vicki's short and submissive answers tell me she doesn't want to reveal the true Vicki or face the facts.
Police say that you killed those patients because you had a problem with them. They annoyed you, or you had a grudge. What do you say to that?
I think it's bull. None of those patients annoyed me.
So that's not true?
No, ma'am.
But when police search Vicky's home, they find a syringe containing a hospital drug that inhibits breathing. When 10 of her victims are exhumed, they all show traces of the same drug.
Someone was injecting a very, very potent paralytic drug into patients who then would stop breathing and died. Why do you think someone would do this?
Because they're evil.
There are cases where medical personnel, caregivers, deliberately attempt to make a patient sick. And they do that so that they can be the one to call everyone to the room and save them, or save them themselves. It's called Munchausen syndrome by proxy. I don't think Vicky was interested in saving anyone. I saw no signs of empathy or remorse or sympathy for her victims. The only time Vicky ever shed a tear was for herself.
Did you kill those people, Vicky?
No, ma'am.
Is there anything you would like to say to the families of the victims?
Yes, ma'am.
What would that be?
I didn't do it, but I understand your hatred for me. Because if the police told me that you killed my mom, I would hate you. So I understand perfectly, and I'm sorry for all your pain, but it wasn't me.
We'll probably never know why Vicky Jackson did what she did. I certainly couldn't get it out of her. But I do know that her lack of empathy or remorse are loud and clear warning signs. Albuquerque, New Mexico, 1991. When master mechanic Mike Snyder falls for 31-year-old Ellen Sheffield. Mike's sister, Terry, believes it's a match made in heaven.
It was very reassuring because Mike is such an introvert, to see him with a woman who was an extrovert. We were pleased. We thought, you know, here's a very outgoing woman who is making a point to fit into our family and to get to know us.
Usually when we meet a new love's family, we're a little guarded, careful what we say, demure. But in this case, Ellen was in a rush. When a new girlfriend ingratiates herself with the family on day one, that could be a warning sign.
I think she was over trying to win our family's approval, but we didn't find that suspect.
Because Ellen is an expert faker. Behind her confident exterior, she hides a powerful gambling addiction and a criminal history of fraud to support it. And she keeps her secret as she and Mike marry and build a comfortable life with a child of their own and the home of their dreams.
It was amazing and did most of the work themselves. So it was a gorgeous home and he was very proud of it.
But the family suffers a blow when Mike is diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
He was a man who worked 14-hour days for most of his life. For my brother, going on disability was emotionally very hard.
Then, in January 2002, the family receives another shock when Ellen tells them Mike has abandoned his family and run off to start a new life. Ellen was looking for sympathy. She was the wronged, dutiful wife who was left behind by a selfish husband. But Michael's family aren't sympathetic. They're suspicious.
My father, I think, had been trying to call my brother for a couple days and wasn't able to reach him. And when Ellen said the story about how he left, that was a huge red flag for my father and our family. I told my parents, this is not right. Things aren't adding up. We need to do something about this. So that's when we went to the police department and asked them to fill out at least a missing persons report.
They get no answers from the police. But when Ellen falls out with a former friend, he goes to the police and breaks his silence and exposes all her secrets and lies, including the revelation that Mike never left the property.
If that informant had not come to the police, she would have gotten away with murder. We would still, to this day, not have my brother's body.
Through her secret gambling, Ellen has squandered Mike's life savings and still has debts of $475,000.
She had signed a second mortgage out on their home and forged his signature.
When Mike discovers her deception, he tells her the marriage is over. They argue, and as Mike turns to leave, Ellen shoots him in the back.
I had always felt that in my heart. I always knew she was his murderer. My brother's last moments were shock, terror, pain. We know that he tried to run. He was shot in the back.
She buries Mike deep in the backyard and resumes her normal life. Ellen was able to live a free life for another 8 years. Ellen Snyder takes a plea deal and is convicted of voluntary manslaughter, tax fraud, and tampering with evidence. She is sentenced to just 11 years and is released in 2018.
Mike's murder affected me in many ways. It's unfortunately made me a person that I'm not really happy with. It's made me angry, cynical. I probably see the worst in people now instead of the best.
That's what makes the faker so damaging, not just to their victim, but to our society as well. Without trust, we're all on our own. Our instincts and emotions can be a great guide most of the time. But sometimes we have to ignore our gut and stick with the facts. We don't have to lose compassion. We just need to see fact from fiction.